Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Commercial fishing has been part of the cultural and economic fabric of this region for generations. Fishing has always been hard work, but changes to the climate, water quality, fish stocks, and restrictions on where, when, and how fin and shellfish are caught have made the profession even more challenging. Today, we discuss the regional small boat fishing fleet and commercial shellfishing, and how fishermen, scientists, and policymakers can work together toward a sustainable fishery. Joining us is Aubrey Church. She's Fisheries Policy Director with the Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance. Hi, Aubrey. Welcome back.
Hi. Good morning.
Shelley Edmondson is Executive Director of the Martha's Vineyard Fishermen's Preservation Trust. Hi, Shelley.
Hi. Good morning.
Josh Reitzman is Marine Program Specialist at the Cape Cod Cooperative Extension and Woods Hole Sea Grant. Hi, Josh.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Aubrey, what are the major fishing ports on the Cape, and how has that changed historically?
Sure. So I think for a lot of people, they don't realize that we have 15 towns on Cape Cod, and each of those towns actually has a fishing port. It is the fabric of our coastal communities. For many, they may think of Chatham as top of mind, but there are a lot of fishing ports that are really successful here on Cape Cod, including Provincetown, Wellfleet, Orleans, Sandwich, you know, even Woods Hole. And I think what we're starting to recognize right now is the importance of supporting those working waterfronts and infrastructure. We're at a pivotal point now, not only with climate change, but just aging fleets and aging dock infrastructure. And so I think this is the kind of pivotal time to educate the community and town officials about why we need to support working waterfronts so that we can continue to have successful commercial fishing.
Yeah. Shelley, what about the Vineyard? I know Menemsha has a fishing fleet. Are there folks fishing out of other ports as well?
Yeah, so Menemsha, I would say, is the heart of the fishing community and culture on the island, but we still have some active other harbors, Oak Bluffs, Vineyard Haven, and Edgartown. We still have boats coming in and out of those harbors, catching fish and, you know, working hard to keep a living in spite of all the challenges of living on an island and the costs of, you know, living.
Everything, yeah.
Everything. It's a lot. You have to, as one fisherman said, you've got to really love it.
Yeah. But how many small boat fishermen do we have regionally, and how has this number changed over the past few decades?
Yeah, so I wanted to look that up so I had the correct statistics. But in 2022 in Barnstable County, there were more than 1,100 fishing businesses. And that can be broken down by wild harvesters. So those are people that are relying strictly on commercial fishing, whether that's for scallop, lobster, groundfish, bluefin tuna, skate, monkfish, quahogs. There's also aquaculture farms, as well as individuals who are just strictly targeting striped bass. I think over the last decade, we have seen a decrease in wild harvest permit holders, and I think some of that can be attributed to COVID, but I think also it can be understanding some of the challenges of running and operating a business, the money to purchase a boat, equipment, permits. It can be a lot of debt for a fisherman to take on. And you oftentimes hear the term graying of the fleet, and that is where it can prevent younger fishermen from entering into the fishery. And so, again, I think this is where we're at a pivotal point where we can be supporting our working waterfront infrastructure, making sure that those fabrics of our community are supported, but also we have programs through the Young Fishermen's Development Act that train young men and women to get into the fishing industry because it is a viable fishery.
And you just mentioned a whole bunch of different species that fishermen fish for, and it changes seasonally, right? So they might be fishing for, you know, one type of fish in the winter and something else in the summer, right?
Yeah, and I think a lot of fishermen are learning that that's an important way to diversify their business portfolio so that they could be successful. So they might be fishing for lobster at a certain time of year and then switch to scalloping, or they may go for groundfish, for cod, haddock, and then switch. So in the summertime, for example, in Chatham, they may be going for skates and for dogfish. And then in the wintertime, they may go farther, deeper off the canyons for monkfish. So I think that they're trying to find ways to follow the fish, and species are changing. Mm-hmm. And so we're witnessing more species moving from New Jersey, you know, north. And so we're having fishermen kind of diversify what they're bringing in. And we're wanting to educate consumers that they should be trying new species that they may not be used to eating.
Yeah. All right, Shelley, how about the fleet in the Vineyard? How has that changed?
Yeah, we've seen a decrease too over time, but I would say that we also have seen some newer people come into it. So it's not a complete, you know, downward trend. You do see new businesses coming in and people taking over retiring permits. So, you know, to me, that gives me hope. Instead of having an older fisherman retire and that permit being lost to our community, having the next generation come in is happening more and more. And, you know, there it changes. It's constantly changing. And I think that, you know, our community has just being on an island, like fishing is a hard business. And then you layer in being in a remote island somewhat, having the dependence of ferries, markets, a seasonal community, climate change, and you have to be clever and committed to run a fishing business. Yeah. And luckily, we still have that commitment here.
You mentioned permits. So explain how fishing permits work. You know, who issues them? How does one get one? Are they required for all fisheries or only certain fisheries? So why don't you start with that, Shelley?
Yeah, sure. So you definitely need a fishing permit to fish. You can have state permits, federal permits, or a combination of the two. It gets very complicated, and the regulations change year to year on what you can harvest and when, but you definitely need a fishing permit. And the prices for permits can range from a couple hundred dollars to multi-millions of dollars, wow, depending on the species and the permit. So it's become, the access to fish is harder, has become harder and harder.
Aubrey, you want to add anything about fishing permits?
Yeah, I think Shelley did a really good job of that. And I think both of our organizations have permit banks that allow us to retain fishing access in our local communities. It can be really challenging. Like when Shelley suggested, you know, a fisherman retires, those permits could end up migrating off Cape Cod or off the vineyard. And so we both care deeply in our communities about making sure that fishermen have access to that quota and to the fishing opportunity. And so we work really hard to provide affordable access so that fishermen are able to access those resources.
What's a permit bank?
A permit bank. Oh, gosh, what's the best way of describing that? Kind of an opportunity to, Shelley, do you help me with this one? I think you probably have a better way of explaining it than me.
Yeah,
I kind of think of it as a library, where a library is holding on to important books for the community, maintaining access. And I think that that's what we do. We want to maintain the access to fish our waters for the species that surround the island, and doing it in a way where we can ensure that the next generation can maintain that in a way that is cost effective during these uncertain.
Yeah, so Shelley, do you buy these? Does the permit bank buy these permits? Like somebody retires, you buy it for the permit bank? How do you acquire these permits?
We do a mixture in our group. So we sometimes buy directly from the fishermen, and then we will sell it to a younger fisherman or whoever's able to accept the permit over time while they're able to fish and make payments on the permit. Mm-hmm. Or we'll just be a connector to two fishermen.
So. Agreed.
Yeah, same thing. Yeah. All right, so we talked about the how the fleet has changed, but what they're catching changing as well, and how much they're catching?
Yeah, I mean, I think, they always talk about the poster child of black sea bass, for example, but that's a species that traditionally has been very abundant in North Carolina, New Jersey, New York, and we're seeing it be really prolific off our coast. It's delicious white fish, but oftentimes managers do not have accurate and timely data on how the resource is doing in our waters. And so it may limit the amount of fish that a fisherman is able to bring in. And so working collaboratively with fishermen and scientists, you'd be able to record how many species are, in our waters and be able to access that. So I always think of black sea bass as kind of one. Even our scallopers are having to fish farther offshore. Lobsters are going into deeper, cooler water. I think species can kind of shift their distribution north to follow the colder water. Others can expand their range. So black sea bass is still prolific in North Carolina, New Jersey, but they're also up here. And then other species can be kind of restricted, and that's like Atlantic cod, where they only have a certain thermal tolerance. And when temperatures are exceeding that, it may be challenging. So I think fishermen right now, you know, they're the jack of all trades. They're resilient. They want to be able to go out and harvest what's abundant. And so they just want to make sure that managers are seeing what species are moving through the water so they can access that and bring that fish in.
Yeah. What about that? I mean, you got a quota, right, that you can only catch so much. And if you're seeing increasing numbers in a certain species like this, does the quota change? And is it timely? That's
what you hope for, but it can take several years for that information to change. It depends on the different species. You know, some, like scallop fishery, is well robust in their data collection and surveys, so that information is readily available for managers. But, for example, black sea bass, they have had to work with a lot of other research organizations to work with fishermen to collect data so that it can inform managers so that the quota can hopefully change in years to come. So I think it can vary the species, but they're often a lag time where they need several years of data before they're willing to change the quotas. And that can be really frustrating for fishermen when they're having to throw back legal size, beautiful fish. Mm-hmm. No fisherman wants to throw back a fish dead. They want to be able to take advantage of that resource.
Oh, that seems like such a waste, right? Ugh. All right. So what is the market for different species? You talked about educating people, like, you know, dogfish, for example. People go, what do I do with a dogfish? So what are the different species, the market here for these different species?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of opportunity to eat local here on Cape Cod. And I always encourage people when they go to their local fish market to ask for different species, and even if they don't see it on the list, because I think oftentimes fish markets are able to get that species if they know that a consumer wants it. Often we see people always want to get salmon, shrimp, tuna, cod, but there's a million other delicious species here off our coast. Scup is my favorite, for example, where I think educating people to try something different, learn how to prepare it. Oftentimes fish could be whole. Like, how do you prepare a whole fish? How do you fillet? So we have resources on our website that link, you know, little YouTube videos of how to break down and fillet a fish, recipes. But I always think, you know, there is power in purchasing local seafood. It reduces carbon footprint. It's making that connection to your local fisherman and harvester. So I think, you know, going to restaurants and asking what's local and seasonal. And some of it may not be landed on Cape Cod, but oftentimes it is. But I think, you know, if you can shrink the geographical distance of where your seafood came from, even if it came from the East Coast or it came in the New England states, that's, you know, really important to know.
And as customers knowing, right, like, I love grouper, but I never buy it up here, right? I mean, I'm thinking, okay, that grouper is far away by the time it gets here,
right?
I mean, you're better off getting something that's in our local waters. It's going to be fresher, right?
Yeah.
And what about the fish that are caught here? Are they staying locally originally, or do we ship them afar?
Some of it's staying local, but oftentimes it's getting shipped, you know, to either to Boston, to New York. It can go overseas as well. I think oftentimes we import a fair amount as well as export. And I think trying to, again, keep a lot of that fish local is important.
Yeah. Shelley?
Same here. I mean, I think that the seafood world is especially complicated because, you know, some fish is being shipped over to China. Some fish is being imported from China. The world is kind of flat when you think about the seafood marketplace. It's just you're competing with a global system. But a lot of our fish stays on the island, but we do end up shipping a lot. The demand just isn't there. We have a seasonal population and a lot of fish. So, challenge.
All right, Josh, tell us more about the commercial shell fishery in Cape and Island waters and what people are fishing for this time of year.
Well, this time of year, you know, it depends on where you are. Hard clams or quahogs have been the long stay within the shell fisheries. That's what folks have sort of lived by. But, you know, in certain areas, razor clams are pretty plentiful. And, you know, where they are, they tend to be in boom and bust cycles. But in certain areas, there's a lot of them. I think there's still some bay scallop harvest going on within the islands and certain communities that have bay scallop populations. They, again, tend to fluctuate quite a bit in their populations, but they tend to be a winter product as well.
Mm-hmm. I know we're talking more commercial, but let me just ask you about recreational fishing for folks with a shellfish license. I usually get my shellfish. I don't think I've ever seen razor clams in recent years. Where are they?
Oh, they're hiding from you.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so they like certain habitats, and they tend to set in high densities in certain areas, but they're also very hard to get. They're very active. They're traditionally called razor fish because they're actually capable of swimming, but they're also capable of really digging away from you as you try to dig them.
So they see me coming.
Exactly. You got to sneak up on them. Or there's some other methods. Salting is one that's become popular where you kind of just stimulate them to come out of their burrow, and then you can just snatch them as they come out. So yeah, there's some pretty cool fisheries if you really are willing to get out there and explore.
All right. So how is the commercial shell fishery regulated? Is it town by town or is it state regulations?
So it is town by town. So Massachusetts is pretty unique in that. There's some other states who have some remnant population or remnant regulatory structure like this, but It's a home rule state, so the state defers to each individual town to manage their shell fisheries as they see fit, with some oversight from the state itself. So each town does set its own sort of regulatory structure for shellfish.
And are commercial shellfish license holders limited to the amount that they can harvest?
Typically, yes. And each town will have different limits, depending on the species and sometimes the time of year. What can be harvested commercially, yes.
Yeah. We'd love to hear from you if you're a small boat fisherman or from a fishing family. Do you enjoy fresh, locally caught seafood? We have questions for you. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the regional small boat fishing fleet and commercial shell fishing and how fishermen, scientists, and policymakers can work together toward a sustainable fishery. 866-999-4626 is our number. What would you like the community to know about you and the local fishing industry? Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us is Aubrey Church, Fisheries Policy Director with the Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance, Shelley Edmondson, Executive Director of the Martha's Vineyard Fishermen's Preservation Trust, and Joss Reitzma, Marine Program Specialist, Cape Cod Cooperative Extension, and Woods Hole Sea Grant. Josh, talk about the rise of shellfish aquaculture in the region and what shellfish is being raised.
Yeah, so over the last few decades, we've certainly seen a lot of growth in the shellfish aquaculture industry. And, you know, that is throughout the region of southeastern Massachusetts, you know, the islands included there. And, you know, the mainstay right now is oysters. 95% or so of production is oysters, so eastern oysters. And then, you know, the industry really started with hard clam production or quahog production, but, you know, oysters were the more economical model that folks have switched to over time. But those are the big two species.
Do you think it's oysters partly because of the reputation of our oysters here on the Cape and Islands?
Yeah, I like to think that's a part of it. Certainly they have good market value, and that's sort of what driven the economic viability of it. There's a lot of value there, and that helps, you know, with the overall economics of farming them.
I was going to say, it's fun just when you're at a restaurant that has oysters from different areas, or you can even do this at a fish market, and to try the different from the different areas and sort of try to figure out, you know, like what the difference salinity is and all of that.
They
taste different, right? I was actually at a restaurant in Sandwich and with a friend, and we were having some oysters, and I said, "Wow, these oysters are really, these are like Wellfleet oysters." And the owner happened to be standing behind me. He goes, "Because they are Wellfleet oysters." But yeah, that's a lot of fun. So talk a little bit about the differences between commercial shellfish and restoration shellfish used to improve water quality. And can the two be merged?
So commercial shellfish production is, you know, it's commercial by nature. It's about making a profit so that it's a profitable business. Well, shellfish restoration tends to have a focus on either restoring the ecological habitat or restoring water quality. It could be, you know, a variety of things that shellfish are important for in the water, you know, really keystone species in the habitats that they thrive in. So, you know, they can be aligned. They have different goals from the start. But, you know, working with aquaculturists in a shellfish restoration sort of aspect is something that we certainly encourage, because I think, you know, there's a lot of know-how there that sort of like gets at what the shellfish restoration goals want to get at.
And a lot of interest, right? I know that you have a lot of programs helping people learn how to be oyster farmers, right?
Sure. Yep. There's a lot of interest in just sort of learning whether oyster farming is right for you or hard clam farming is right for you. And, you know, we do offer some educational programming in that. And then, you know, overall, you know, it is an industry that has had growth. It's, you know, we're seeing some plateauing of that growth as, you know, usable space becomes limited, you know, for this purpose, I should say. But, you know, it is an industry that has seen a lot of growth, and there's a lot of interest there.
Yeah. And Shel, I know probably aquaculture is not up your alley, but we see a lot of them in the vineyard, too.
Yeah, definitely. I would say we have 16 to 20 oyster farms on the island. And sometimes the commercial fishermen would also run an oyster farm, too. So there, you see this blending of the businesses.
Yeah. In Massachusetts, shellfish farms have to get both what state and local approvals. So tell us how the regulations work.
How do they work? So, yeah, there's actually the state has a great website now that has like a 14-step process for getting a shellfish
14-step.
14-step process, yeah. So, yeah, it does start at the local level. The municipality has control over licensing a site first, and that comes from the Board of Selectmen. And then if they are approved for a site with the Board of Selectmen, it then goes to the State Division of Marine Fisheries for certification. So they'll come in and survey the site, make sure you're not taking away, important other, wild fish habitat, whether that's fish or shellfish. And, look at other aspects of the site and make sure that there's regulatory compliance there. And then it would go on to different federal agencies for review as well. The biggest one there is the Army Corps of Engineers. So it's a lengthy process.
It takes a while, I would imagine, then, right?
To start from scratch, it takes a while.
And shellfish farming has not been without controversy, right? There are people who've complained that they mar the view. How has the state or local towns dealt with that issue of neighbors saying, I don't want this in my backyard? And that's a problem really more in the United States than elsewhere, right?
Hard for me to say that it's not a problem across the globe. I'm sure it probably is, depending on where you are. But yeah, in certain areas here, the popular waters for growing shellfish are also the popular waters for people to have, land on the water. So you're in the view shed there, and there's certain aspects that certain people don't want to see, and that is understandable. But there's also some interchange there between the farmers and the landowners. And, really what I've seen over the years is it comes down to relationships there and educating and understanding what each side is concerned about and sort of finding the common ground where, I think everybody acknowledges they want shellfish in the water because there's benefits to the shellfish, but, want it to be done in a way that they're okay with. Yeah.
And there's different methods, right?
Sure.
So talk a little bit, just some of the more popular methods, and the view would be different. And also depending where you are on the Cape, if you're in the Outer Cape, it's a little different than if you're on the Upper Cape.
Yeah. So traditionally shellfish were grown without any sort of gear. and as the industry has evolved, there's been many different gear types that have developed over the years. And a lot of them come from France or Australia or other parts of the world. Some developed here as well. Traditionally shellfish would just be grown on the bottom, sort of purchased as seed, maybe grown in some sort of nursery habitat, and then planted on the bottom when they're a little bit more robust. But now there's a variety of gears that can be, just off the bottom to get them more access to the water, suspended in the water column, or even floating at the surface. So yeah, there's, 30 plus types of gear that I can think of on the top of my head. So yeah, there's a lot of ways to do it.
All right. So what's the market for the different shellfish species, both kind of here locally and then expanding?
So yeah, the market really is the restaurant market typically. So, shellfish were very hard hit when, restaurants were closed during COVID. So that was a prime example of how reliant shell fisheries are on the restaurant market. So yeah, it's really reliant on restaurants and the raw bar sort of aspects of those restaurants.
Mm-hmm. And what happened like during COVID? You said it was impacted. I mean, did they just have, because they have a short lifespan, right? I mean, if you don't use them.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. There is a short lifespan on the product. Oysters will grow for the course of their life. But the market value is highest at an ideal size, an ideal market size, that 3 to 4 inch size or so.
All right. And then, of course, climate change is warming our regional waters. So how is this impacting the shell fishermen?
Yeah, so I think there's been a lot of talk about how fishermen and farmers are adaptable, right? And, it's just required a lot of adaptability. Things are changing. The biofouling community becomes important in farming and what you're dealing with biofouling. So adapting to changing conditions there, the seasons, it's a little longer growing season now for shellfish. They tend to shut down during the winter, but that actual growing season is getting a little bit longer. So adapting to when you're purchasing seed and things like that have all sort of changed over time with shellfish aquaculture. So adaptability is key.
Yeah. Actually, we're having some technical problems with our phones this morning. So you can shoot us an email with your comments or questions at thepoint@capeandislands.org. Climate change is causing marine organisms that are mobile, finfish, crabs, cephalopods, jellies, to shift north, as you mentioned, Aubrey, earlier. How are these changes impacting fishermen currently?
Yeah, I think for many fishermen, they're, for the small boat fleet here on Cape Cod, they're kind of restricted by the size of their vessel and how far they can go offshore safely. And so they're now having to make that hard decision on if they're going to be fishing farther offshore as these species continue to move into deeper and cooler water. So that's one kind of immediate impact. Also, just the severity of storms that they're witnessing. Also, the bottom temperature has been something that's impacted them, where they're, you know, maybe being used to a certain time of year in the spring, having a certain bottom temperature. And this last year or two, it's been much colder. So they felt like things didn't really start waking up or moving until a few months later. And so when there are certain seasons for when they can harvest, then, you know, they want to make sure that they're able to capitalize on that total amount of catch that they're able to bring in. But if the fish don't start moving for a month or two, then they're kind of having a slow start to their fishing season. And I think many fishermen, you know, are trying before they even leave the dock to think about, you know, how much money they're in the hole from fuel, from crew, from groceries. And so really trying to make sure that when they leave the dock, they're able to bring in enough to support themselves and maintain their vessels.
Yeah. Shelley, want to add anything to that?
I think Aubrey did a great job, but I think, you know, climate change has just increased the uncertainty in the fishery world. And there always was uncertainty, but it just keeps getting more and more harder to predict what's going to be next season.
One of the things we see with the warming temperatures, and we did a program with the green crabs a few weeks back, but the shellfish are, a very favorite food of those green crabs. But one thing we were talking about before we went is that we'd had a little bit colder winter this year. The last couple winters have not been that cold, and usually that kicks them back a little bit, right, Josh?
Yeah, that's sort of the ongoing theory. They don't do well after a really cold winter. It seems to knock their populations back. So I am knocking on wood here that is going to be the case this year, where maybe we'll see a little less pressure from green crabs in this coming year.
Do you hear that from shellfish farmers that are having issues with the green crabs?
Yeah, shellfish farmers and shellfish constables, so the folks in each individual town that sort of work with shell fisheries and, you know, are concerned about, you know, predators like the green crabs. That, yeah, you know, your green crabs certainly flux like many other things, and cold winters do seem to help sort of control the population.
Yeah. And you mentioned that, you know, we talked about seed, how farmers get seed. And I think people go, what do they mean they get seed? So tell us a little bit about that process, where these shellfish farmers, what that seed process is.
Yeah. So very much like terrestrial farming, or dirt farming, we call it. I'm used to working with farming in the water, so I call it dirt farming. You need a product to start with, right? Shellfish farmers will buy shellfish seed from hatcheries that specialize in spawning the adult animals and producing the teeny tiny seed shellfish that a farmer will then utilize, you know, to grow their business.
All right. Let's talk to Lindsay calling from Chatham. Hope our phones work. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, good morning.
Yay. Go ahead. Go ahead, Lindsay.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah.
I just wanted to call and talk a little bit about the importance of local sustainable seafood.
Yeah, go ahead.
And also just talk a little bit more about Chatham. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Chatham Harvesters.
Aubrey's shaking her head yes.
Yeah.
Yes. They provide local sustainable seafood and shares of seafood, and it connects the fishermen to our community and makes it affordable and attainable, the seafood.
Yeah, that's a good, Lindsay, thank you for that. Aubrey, you want to talk a little more about that?
Yeah,
thank
I was
you,
just
going
to say thank you, Lindsay. And I think it's a great opportunity for people to also be trying different things that they may not be used to, like mackerel. I know that Chatham Harvesters also has that. Monkfish sliders, giving people the opportunity to kind of see a species that they may not know a lot about, but then have it be in a packaging that's easy for someone to try at home and not be intimidated by trying something new. So I agree that that's a great organization. And they travel a lot. They even go to Falmouth sometimes to, I think, Aquatic Brewery to talk to the community about what they do and commercial fishing. So they are definitely trying to make sure people are aware about the great work that commercial fishermen do to provide local sustainable seafood.
Yeah, and I would say, and also a lot of the fishermen, you know, donate to the pantries, the food pantries, right? I mean, Shelley, we were just talking about this before we went on the air. Some fish cakes that just recently, from, the, was it Black Sea Bass?
Black Sea Bass, right, yeah. So we run a seafood donation program as well. And just 2 days ago, we donated 1,200 packs of Black Sea Bass fish cakes caught by local fishermen. And so it's great to be able to connect the dots and have the local fishermen provide food for the community and kind of eliminate those economic boundaries that and barriers that are often in place with local seafood.
866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the regional small boat fishing fleet and commercial shell fishing and how fishermen, scientists, and policymakers can work together toward a sustainable fishery. With us is Aubrey Church, Fisheries Policy Director with the Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance, Shelley Edmondson, Executive Director of the Martha's Vineyard Fishermen's Preservation Trust, and Josh Reitzma, Marine Program Specialist, Cape Cod Cooperative Extension, and Woods Hole Sea Grant. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you can't get through on the phone, we're having some like little intermittent problems here with the phone lines, then you can always also send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So what are some of the questions fishermen and fishery biologists have about future impacts of warming waters on the fishing industry? Anybody who wants to chime in on that?
I'll let Shelley start.
Shelley? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all wondering what's coming next and who's eating what and how that will change and where the temperature changes. And I think the more we can pull fishermen into collecting data to help answer those questions and be able to be flexible as these answers come in and help with, you know, not only the gathering of data, but the regulations that are involved in harvesting, the stronger and more sustainable our fisheries will be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think fishermen are starting to realize that being involved in collaborative research is another avenue and revenue stream that can help support their businesses. Climate change is making things very uncertain. And so also being able to work collaboratively with the fishing industry is allowing them to have a guaranteed paycheck month to month and be involved in research that they can then have industry buy-in and believe in. So many of them have oceanographic sensors on their boats where they're able to collect bottom temperature. So that's not only interesting for the fishermen because it allows them to refine their fishing practices. It might allow them to move to deeper, cooler water or try to find the sweet spot for lobsters or Jonah crabs, for example, but it also allows scientists to get real-time data. Often scientists are at the whim of two surveys a year, so they're not getting a lot of accurate data year-round. And so being able to work closely with the fishing industry out on the water every day really gives us a wealth of knowledge.
Yeah, and I think that, fishermen and scientists, that people have this idea that they're always at odds with one another, right? But there are so many opportunities for collaborations between scientists and fishermen. And the fishermen really are a great resource given their local knowledge and experience, right? So you're naming some things that we can do. Shelley, are there other things, other collaborations that you can think of that people should know about?
Yeah, I mean, I think just to your point of, having scientists and fishermen collaborate, that's really the only way that we can start to answer these questions and address the concerns that we have. We're working on some collaborative bait work, so trying to get away from using horseshoe crabs as whelk or conch bait. Mm-hmm. And we can't do that without the input and support of the fishing industry. You could develop something in a lab that works really great, but unless you test it and it works out in the field and is economically viable, you have no solution. So right. Collaboration is key.
How about in the shellfishing industry?
Yeah, I mean, I've always found that people who are working on the water have a lot of stories and anecdotes about what they're seeing and changes they're seeing. So I've been doing a lot of work lately to try to collect their anecdotes and share that with researchers so that we can sort of build projects related to what folks are seeing on the water.
Yeah, that's a good point because it's anecdotal, right? And you go, okay, but now can we prove it? Right? I mean, so having this anecdotal knowledge gives scientists something to go for, right, to check out.
Certainly for a manager to have to use that data, you know, and they can believe a fisherman, but they need sort of the data put together, right?
And I also just think that a lot of fishermen are now starting to, you know, have these good relationships with scientists, that they're coming to us with research ideas instead of the scientists saying, hey, we have this project, do you want to be involved? Mm-hmm. And I think that makes a huge difference, is that when you have fishermen are out on the water and they have a question about scallop resource and are they spawning at different times of year? Are they spawning more than normal? You know, then they can come to us and we can work on finding the funding to then do the work. So I think that's really building that trust and collaboration, is getting the fishermen to ask questions and then us as scientists trying to find the research and funding to do so.
Right there, they're going, find the funding? I mean, that's always a scientist's biggest question,
yeah,
right? Who's going to fund this, right? Yeah. So
NOAA
Fisheries Services is a federal agency that's tasked with the stewardship of the nation's marine resources. The agency is tasked with stock assessments and creating fishing quotas, but they also work hand-in-hand with fishermen on research and policy. So talk about that relationship between NOAA and local fishermen.
Yeah, I think historically there has always been kind of a disconnect or distrust in NOAA, in that every year their amount of fish that they're going to be able to bring in is going to get reduced, or why should we trust having a NOAA scientist on my boat? They're just a spy, or things like that. I think that some of that relationship has changed, again, based on building that trust and transparency, working closely with the fishing industry, hearing what they have to say anecdotally, but also trying to prove it through data. But I also think, you know, many fishermen rely on the weather from NOAA fisheries. It provides life-saving weather forecasting. Before they even leave the dock, they're looking to make sure that they know, you know, what's safe for them to go out on. I also think that they are using that information in order to inform their business plan for the year ahead. I think NOAA is doing the best they can to collect information scientifically on their surveys that they do a few times a year, but they also have branches of NOAA, like the Cooperative Research Branch, that works collaboratively with the fishing industry to get more real-time data into the system.
Shelley, want to add anything?
Aubrey did a great job. I think one concern that we're seeing with NOAA right now is just the staff that they need to open and close our fisheries. You know, that's really essential. And if you don't have the staff to close a fishery when it needs to be closed or open it, I think that some of these changes that we're seeing, the impacts are yet to come, but we will start to see them soon.
Yeah, I was just going to add, so each year's catch limits in areas that are open to fishing rely on new regulations being published each year. And so they replace the previous year's regulations. So recently, with the presidential executive order, it mandates that we remove 10 regulations for every new regulation. And that becomes really problematic now for fisheries management, because with all the uncertainty right now in the federal government and with NOAA fisheries, it's becoming apparent that it's creating delays in the start of fishing year. For example, the scallop fishery is supposed to open April 1st. We know that that won't happen this time. It will open with the default measure, which is a less amount of days of sea of fishing and pounds until it can be enacted. So some of those delays are causing concerns for the fishing industry.
Yeah. I was going to ask you how the Trump administration cuts to NOAA and the Fisheries Service impact local fishermen, but both immediately and in the long term, right? There's impacts for both.
Yeah, I think that's the concern right now, that, you know, in the short term, the fishermen are trying to understand, you know, one, which staff have been let go that they can no longer talk to in terms of permits, renewals and things like that, but also in terms of when they can actually start their fishing season, either April 1st or May 1st. Are they going to be delayed due to these executive orders that are requiring removal of 10 different regulations before they can publish a new one? And that's concerning.
How about for the shellfish industry? Are there any kind of implications from the current administration that's impacting them?
You know, I think the answer that it's yet to be seen, I think, is a big one. These cuts are all very new, and it's hard to know the depth of where it's all going to go. You know, shell fisheries are regulated at that sort of local level, so we don't see it immediately, but I do think there's going to be impacts down the
road. And just the uncertainty, right? Uncertainty is very unsettling. Yeah, Shelley, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd just like to add, you know, our conch or whelk fishery is primarily an exported product, and it primarily goes to Asia, to China, and the tariffs might make this fishery collapse. So I think that we're seeing a lot of concern in species that are imported or exported.
Yeah. Yeah, because again, uncertainty there as well. So we have, you know, the shift in policies that could impact the fishermen. We have the tariffs on the exports, the opening and closing of the fishing grounds. Are you hearing from Aubrey from fishermen about this uncertainty? Because, you know, whenever there's uncertainty, there's a lot of speculation, and we don't know what's going to happen. But the speculation can almost be as hard to deal with as these actual changes, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, just recently we had a policy meeting with the scallopers that we work with, the limited access general category small day boat, and there was a lot of concerns, and I was trying to break down, okay, well, if it opens on April 1st, it's this scenario. If it's delayed, it's this scenario, you know, and they're trying to figure out how they can think about their business plan. Okay, am I, you know, even some scallopers up in Maine, you know, are they going to go scalloping? Are they going to go lobstering longer until the season, you know, allows them to go into an area? So I think Some of the fishermen weren't even aware that there was going to be the potential for these delays, and others were, and they were like, what does this mean for my business? And you know, what happens on April 1st? So I do think there's a lot of uncertainty, and it's really unsettling when you're trying to think about how you're going to plan your business for the year, and making sure that you can support your families and their crew.
Yeah. Shelley, I imagine you're hearing the same.
Yes, definitely. And I think it's hard because at this time of year, a lot of people are putting in the funds to get their boats ready and their gear ready. And that's a lot of money that you're fronting on the hope that you're going to actually harvest. And if you can't harvest, you know, those bills get stretched out. And at some point it becomes, you know, a real hardship on your business.
What do you see as some of the more important changes to fisheries management to support small boat fishermen and promote sustainable fisheries? Aubrey, we'll start with you.
I think there has been a big, shift probably over the last decade, especially at the New England Fishery Management Council, about thinking more holistically about predator-prey dynamics, about including climate data and ecosystem considerations into management. I think historically, you know, we've heard from a lot of fishermen about how these ocean is changing and it's impacting the species and the distribution. But historically, they've only managed species by an individual basis. And so they're not considering all these other factors that might be contributing to the upswing or downswing of a species. So I think we're really starting to see the importance of incorporating climate data and thinking more about adaptive management. So thinking more real time about how we can start making changes to improve quota, you know, to allow fishermen to land more black sea bass, for example, or thinking, what can we do to make sure that we're being nimble and that we have the best data possible to make informed decisions?
Shelley?
Yeah, I would just add that, you know, it's great that technology has gotten to a place where fishermen can have tools on their boat that can easily allow them to integrate data collection. So they have tablets with ways that they can seamlessly measure what's needed to be measured and wirelessly upload the data to collaborators and scientists. So I think having a small boat, independent fisherman that cares about their harvesting area and their community and now can be interconnected to the regulations in the collection, it's really the path towards sustainability.
Josh?
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, environmental monitoring is something we work with farmers on too. But I want to talk a little bit more about the shoreline and just, you know, there's a lot of talk about the cost of doing business. You know, it's an expensive place to live and it's an expensive place to do business. And it's becoming harder, you know, just the cost of pulling your boats out of the water and servicing your boats and storing your gear, where are you going to do that and how much that costs? It all costs a lot. So, you know, unless there's sort of community engagement on, you know, identifying this industry as important to the community and sort of making it a little bit easier for folks to do that, whether that's, you know, access to the water to pull the harvest out and put the boats in. Certainly, whether it's fishing or farming, that's a big deal. So, yeah, I think there just needs to be, you know, community recognition about the importance of the industry.
And more, Aubrey, you said this earlier, the more important of the infrastructure. It isn't just the boats on the water. It's the working waterfront.
Right. And I think, you know, you were talking a little bit earlier about, you know, the shellfish and not in my backyard. But I mean, even similar with commercial fishing piers, you know, Chatham Fish Pier is a perfect example, right? You know, smack next to a really expensive, great hotel. You know, we're dealing on Cape Cod a lot with gentrification, and we need to make sure the community members see the value in both shellfish and commercial fishing and on the vineyard as well, that these are viable. They're really important to the Cape Cod Blue economy. They mm-hmm. provide thousands of jobs. You know, they are really important to the fabric of our communities, but we need community support and we need town officials to be able to recognize the importance of working waterfront infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance has a documentary coming out later this spring titled Small Boats, Big Taste. What do you want to tell us about the film?
Yeah, so the Small Boats Big Taste program was started right around COVID as a way to work with the commercial fishing industry to keep them fishing on the water, but also provide delicious seafood to people in our community who need it. And so it's allowed us to start it out with the haddock chowder. We also have a Provençal fish stew, which is a tomato-based skate, which is actually very delicious. It's really good. Now we have a clam chowder, but it's a way of putting them in packaging that if you were only had a hot plate in your hotel room, you could still feed your family and it'd be very nutritious. And so it's really a sense of pride for a lot of commercial fishermen being involved in this program is because they're allowing the community to be well supported and feed their families with delicious seafood.
All right. I want to know from each of you what your favorite local fish would be. And I think you already said scup, Aubrey, right?
Yeah, scup is my favorite. It's a highly abundant, underutilized species. And it's something that if you just had a recreational fish permit, you could go out. You don't need a boat. You could go right from the beach. And it's a beautiful, shiny.
And how do you prepare it?
How do I prepare it? Well, you can eat it whole, which is what I've done on the grill, but you can also fillet it. And then I make scup tacos with a mango pineapple salsa. It's really good.
All right. Shelley, how about you?
I'd have to go with fluke. I love fluke in any form. We're actually working on a seafood cookbook right now, and I keep testing the recipes in the cookbook. And each time I test, you know, black sea bass or fluke or scup, I'm like, this is my favorite. No, this is my favorite. So
it depends on the day, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And what a great idea to do the cookbook, because I think there are a lot of people who would want to try, you know, like dogfish or something that you can get locally, but they don't know what to do with it, right? All right, Josh, your favorite.
Well, I agree with both Aubrey and Shelley, but I think my favorite, well, I love oysters as well, is probably the black sea bass. It's just, it's such a good all-around fish.
And how do you prepare it?
Well, my kids love it fried, so we end up frying it a lot, but I think it's great, you know, just simply baked, you know, with a little bit of butter. It's good.
Yeah. All right. Last, I want to just talk a little bit about fishing families. You know, we've seen this sort of generational thing, right, where it kind of, you know, your great-grandfather and your grandfather and your father. And it seems like at least the last decade anyway, maybe a little longer than that, some of the fishing families we talk to are now saying they don't want their children to get into this business because of the reasons of the rising costs, the lack of infrastructure, the regulations. What is that? Do you hear that from the fishermen that you work with, the fishing families?
I think that I hear that from some families, but I also think we have several board members who have their sons still actively fishing, or they just bought their, you know, first fishing boat and they're really proud. So I think it's a mix. I think there is definitely concerns, you know, like with any business, you know, about the uncertainty of the fishery, the stability of the prices and the market, you know, competing internationally. But I do think, you know, many of the fishermen I talk to, they're encouraging their sons to, and daughters.
And daughters, yeah.
Yeah, and daughters,
that,
yeah.
About a minute left, Shelley. What are you hearing?
I too, on the island, we see more hope than despair. We see the next generation coming in, whether it's not, you know, a direct generation, but it's the neighbor or the deckhand or someone, but I feel a lot of hope from the next generation.
Yeah, and I mean, the freedom of being out there on the water, and like I said, jack of all trades, jack and Jill of all trades. And then, of course, we're seeing more and more interest, obviously, in the aquaculture farming as well.
Yeah, and we see second generation farmers, which is also very encouraging. It is a hard business, but, you know, if done right, it can be profitable. And yeah, it's heartening to see.
Aubrey Church, Fisheries Policy Director with the Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance. Shelley Edmondson is Executive Director of the Martha's Vineyard Fishermen's Preservation Trust. Josh Reitzma is the Marine Program Specialist, Cape Cod Cooperative Extension, and Woods Hole Sea Grant. We'll post the links to each of these organizations at our website, capeandislands.org. Thank you all for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.